Welcome back to the Groundless Ground podcast, the leading edge of mental health. I'm your host, Lisa Dale Miller. Remember, you can now subscribe to and download the Groundless Ground on your favorite podcast app or listen on YouTube, Spotify, and TuneIn. You're about to hear a Dharma talk I gave on May 6, 2018 at Marin Sangha on the topic of karma and reincarnation, somewhat controversial and yet somewhat interesting as well.
I'd like to tread on the territory of karma and reincarnation as understood in the early Buddhist teachings. If you're interested in more in-depth engagement on this topic, I want you to know a new book comparing rebirth in early Buddhism and current research on past lives and near-death experiences. It's a Wisdom Publications. It's called Rebirth in Early Buddhism and Current Research, and the author is Bhikkhu Anilayo, and it's actually really good. He's quite the scholar. Now, my interest in karma and reincarnation is purely speculative. I do not find belief in past lives necessary for recognizing right view, ascertaining right intention, or aligning with the Buddha's instructions for ethical conduct. And of greatest importance, the existence or non-existence of past lives matters little to me when it comes to the many forms of mind training offered and practiced in the wide array of Buddhist schools. So that's my own position. However, contemplating the ramifications of karma and reincarnation is interesting nonetheless. And of course, let's be clear, the Judeo-Christian Islamic afterlife is related to karma by way of determining what realm one might end up in after death. However, return to earthly form is not an option in these traditions, like it is in Buddhism. So, just want to be clear. I thought we'd begin with an interesting take on karma from the Pali texts. I'm going to read you the Anguttara Nikaya 399, that's the number. It's called the Lonapala Sutta, otherwise known as the Salt Crystal Sutta. Some of you may have had teachings on this before from other Buddhist teachers, and maybe not. How many people have ever heard of the Salt Crystal Sutta? This is the Buddha speaking to Ananda, his cousin and faithful attendant, by way of teaching the monks. The Buddha says, "One who says, in whatever way a person makes karma, that is how it is experienced. For that person, there is no living of the holy life. There is no opportunity for the right ending of stress. However, one who says, when a person makes karma to be felt in such and such a way, that is how its result is experienced. And for that person, there is the opportunity for the right ending of stress. There is the case where a trifling evil deed done by a certain individual takes him to a hellish place. There is also the case where the very same sort of trifling deed done by another individual is experienced in the here and now, and for the most part, barely appears for a moment. When an individual is undeveloped in contemplating the body, undeveloped in virtue, undeveloped in mind, undeveloped in discernment, restricted, small-hearted, and dwelling with suffering, for that person, a trifling evil deed done by them takes them to a very hellish place. Alternatively, when an individual is developed in contemplating the body, developed in virtue, developed in mind, and developed in discernment, unrestricted, large-hearted, dwelling with the immeasurable, a trifling deed done by this sort of individual is experienced in the here and now, and for the most part, barely appears for a moment. Suppose, Ananda, that a man were to drop a salt crystal into a small amount of water in a cup, What do you think? Would the water in the cup become salty because of the salt crystal and unfit to drink? Ananda replied, Well, yes, Buddha. There being only a small amount of water in the cup, it would become salty because of the salt crystal and unfit to drink. Now, Ananda, the Buddha said, suppose that a man were to drop a salt crystal into the river Ganges. What do you think? Would the water in the river Ganges become salty because of the salt crystal or unfit to drink? Ananda replied, Well, no. There being a great mass of water in the river Ganges, it would not become salty because of the salt crystal or unfit to drink. In the same way, there is the case where a trifling evil deed done by one individual, which takes them to a hellish place. And then there is the case where the very sort of trifling deed done by the other individual is experienced in the here and now, and for the most part, barely appears for a moment. So this is a very interesting sutta, is it not? A very different way of thinking about karma, wouldn't you say? So before I say anything about what I think, what came up for you when you heard this particular take that the Buddha has on karmic deeds and the effect that they have depending on how your mind is experiencing them?
It seems to me, from what you said, that the overall pattern is developed and you're generally aware and kind and living a virtuous life. If your life is generally virtuous in the sense that the Ganges is generally wet, like in a big sense, and you're generally going in the right direction, then one small misdeed is not going to send you to a hell realm as quickly as if you're living a confined teacup kind of life.
In terms of a generosity of spirit, that if that's who you are in the world and in your interactions,
yes,
you can have a snap flare of temper or something, and there's a lot of generosity and spirit.
If I'm in a place of equanimity, then I can see a failure in myself and say, yes, that came and rose, it's gone. And if I'm not in that place, then I hit myself with that second arrow and take myself into the hell realm of blame and judgment.
So you're all correct, and you've saved me a lot of work. Thank you very much. One of the things that I want to be very, very clear about is the Buddha is pointing very strongly at mental training. And what the Buddha is saying is that, oh, and by the way, the hell realm is not actual hell. The hell realm that the mind makes, the mentally generated suffering about experience. For any of you who are in the mental health world, you know you probably work all day long with people who are extremely well schooled in generating mental suffering for themselves and getting very stuck and fixated on stories that exist in their mind that do not exist anywhere else other than their mind. So a small, trifling, little thing, either done by them or someone else, becomes huge. It just becomes so big and creates so much suffering. Remember, the Buddha said here and now. He was very specific about here and now. The trifling evil is being done even with a mind that's somewhat awake and aware, which should tell you something. Enlightenment and awakening does not preclude mistakes. We're human. If you're awake in the middle of a mistake, the ramifications of such an act will be much less. That's essentially what the Buddha is saying. So in terms of karma and having ramifications from your actions, whether it's in this life or if you believe other lives, then we can extend it there as well. The ramifications of what we think and do has everything to do with whether or not we are there and present in the actual thoughts and acts. This is key, and it makes the difference between a brittle mind that's rigid and will cause a lot of harm for itself and others, and a dynamically responsive mind that's aware. And even when our karmic propensities show up, as they do, because we all have our habits, we recognize, look what just happened. And then the ramifications of it are much less. And that's only because of presence. Does this make sense? Mm-hmm. Now, as far as rebirth and reincarnation go, some of you may be familiar with Dr. Ian Stevenson, who has now passed on. He was a psychiatrist at the University of Virginia for many years. And much of his work investigated around 3,000 cases of children from all over the world who claimed to recall a past existence. He published numerous articles and books based on this work. Some of the children he interviewed seemed able to provide detailed information about their former lives and how they actually died. And in some cases, these facts that the children were saying were reportedly corroborated by other people who knew them in their earlier incarnation. A number of the children also bore birthmarks that seemed to correspond to wounds incurred through violent deaths in a past life. Sounds like pretty strong evidence on the face of it. For me, while these cases may support the Buddhist belief in rebirth, they really don't inform me about the relationship traditional Buddhism posits between the doctrine of karma, which is a theory of cosmic justice meted out as reward and retribution, and rebirth, the container in which karmic payback plays out in succeeding lives. It doesn't really say much about that to me. And in fact, Stephen Batchelor somewhat agrees. He's actually a more staunch opponent of reincarnation and past lives. His book, After Buddhism, claims, he says, in the absence of such an underlying theory of cosmic justice, the phenomena of rebirth is meaningless. Now, for an alternate perspective, I'm going to go to Nagasena, who was a Sarvastivadin Buddhist sage born in Kashmir around 150 BC. And he was most prominently known for answering King Milinda's questions. Many Buddhist teachers teach the suttas that include King Milinda asking questions of Nagasena. And Nagasena said this of such naysaying on reincarnation. You think that soul and body together perish. How sad. Transformations go on without interruption. Causes and conditions cooperate and pass on their impulses. Fire leaps from wood to wood. Leaping fire can be compared to the soul transmigrating through bodies. The second body being different from the first one, we know how strongly our will to live yearns for continued existence. A fool, when he sees a body dissolving at the end of life, believes that the will to live of the soul also perishes. That's what Nagasena said. What he's really arguing is that if mind is not made of matter, why should it die along with the body? So I'm kind of leaving this to you as an open question, because there are a lot of strong arguments for and against past lives and reincarnation throughout the Buddhist teachings. Some Buddhist traditions, it's a very, very strong thing. But I assure you, during that first Congress and the third Congress, there were a lot of different sects of Buddhism that held all kinds of different ideas. One of the things that Bhikkhu Anilayo tries to do in his new book is put forth a middle way argument about past lives and reincarnation. So I'm going to read you a little bit of what he says from his book. It's just one paragraph. What one experiences now is the fruition, not just of past karma in the sense of one's past deeds, but also of factors like bodily disorders, climate change, or external violence. This shows that in early Buddhist thought, the results of karma operate within a network of various causes and conditions. Karma does not exercise its influence in a monocausal manner. In other words, if you do this, it turns into this. The doctrine of karma is therefore clearly not deterministic. Instead, one's volitional decisions taken in the present moment are the only one factor in a network of interrelated conditions that will influence one's future. The emphasis is often on the factor of volitional decisions, because it is the one condition amenable to being brought under control through mental training. So I really, really like what he's saying here, because he's actually pointing back at the Salt Crystal Sutta. Mental training makes the difference in the quality of the results of our thoughts, words, and deeds. And he's insisting that of the five aggregates, which in the Pali tradition and also in the Mahayana tradition, continues through all the Buddhist vehicles. Five aggregates are the qualities that any moment is basically made up of. And one of them is volitional action or volitional intention or volitional dispositions. It kind of includes them all. It's this wonderful mix of here's my habits, my volitional habits, the things I do automatically without thinking, many of which can be very unskillful. Here's how I intercede volitionally in order to not get caught in my habitual actions, which in fact may cause me and others harm. Volitional dispositions is this funny space of mental training. You can actually have an effect here and now on your karmic habits, which is the good news of Buddhist practice, right? Things can change. For the Buddha and early Buddhists, the definitive result of mental training is to see through the veil of conventional reality and behold the hidden, interdependent, empty nature of reality. So why do I mention this now? The kind of here and now experience that the Buddha is pointing at is an experience that occurs from within a mind that is able to actually perceive the interdependent nature, the empty nature of itself, as well as all phenomena. That makes the difference between the person who goes into a hellish realm around their particular difficult words or actions or thoughts, and somebody who it may happen for a moment, but then it's gone. In fact, I'm going to read you another sutta. This time, the sutta features a nun named Sila, and she actually points at all of this by saying, "There is only a collection of empty aggregates. There is no living being. Independence on the combination of the aggregates, there is the designation a living being." You know, designation is not such a big deal in the Theravada vehicle, even though it was a huge deal for the Buddha. Somehow it's gotten missed and lost. Over in the Mahayana world, especially in Majjhimaka, designation, labels, concepts is huge. For them, everything is just a label and a concept. There's no independent existence of anything. And everything is kind of like Kant. For any of you who read Kant in your philosophy classes, everything is just concepts and labels. What is this?
A striker.
Are you sure? It looks like one, yes. Your mind just did name form. Ah, I've seen that before. What's it made of? Wood and cloth. It's no longer a striker. Now it's an object that's made of wood and cloth. Okay, so we've just gone down a level of labels, right? Do all strikers look like this?
I know one when I see one.
Concepts and labels. That's all this is, concepts and labels. Okay, so wood and cloth. Are you sure? What's wood and cloth made of?
Trees and plants.
Okay, so it's not really wood and cloth, right? It's trees and plants. And what are trees and plants made of? Carbon. And on and on and on. And the Majjhimaka school, these Buddhist scholars basically kept breaking everything down. They were atomists, so they didn't know anything beyond atoms, right? God, they would have such a great time today with physics and science, wouldn't they? There's a whole with parts. The parts make the whole. This is interdependence. I've just done emptiness for you. Does this make sense?
Yeah.
This is empty of any inherent existence as a striker only because of all the other things it actually is. And that's how the aggregates work. Form, feeling, consciousness, perception, volitional dispositions. That's all you're made of. Everything you think, feel, say, do, just that. It's just a collection all together. That's interdependent co-arising. So I'm going to read you the Sila Sutta, which, by the way, is in the Samyutta Nikaya. It's 5.9. The bhikkhuni Sila sat at the foot of a tree for her day's calm abiding meditation practice. At some point, Sila realized her mind was lost in mental suffering. And bhikkhuni Sila considered, what is the source of this suffering and why does it distract my mind from concentration? In order to answer this question, she reflected and then surmised the following. This mental suffering is not made by itself, nor is this misery made by another. It has come to be dependent on a cause, and when the cause dissolves, the mental suffering will cease. As when a seed is sown in a field, it requires both the soil's nutrients and a steady supply of moisture. Just so, the aggregates and elements, and these six sense bases of sensory contact, by the way, for the Buddhists, there's the five senses and consciousness. Field of mind is the sixth sense in Buddhism. So she says, just so, the aggregates and elements, and these six bases of sensory contact have come to be dependent on a cause. When the cause dissolves, they will cease. And right then, Bhikkhuni Sila's mental suffering disappeared. So when you think about this sutta in terms of karma, Bhikkhuni Sila is essentially saying is wise understanding of the nature of suffering frees us from further making of karma. This is very important because a lot of people think of karma as something you can't do anything about. You're reaping it from the past and you're making it in the present and you'll experience it in the future. But in Buddhism, we have mental training to liberate ourselves from such constructs. When we talk about karma and we talk about reincarnation, part of the problem is we're treading on what I call unanswerable questions. Now, I don't know about you, but these do appear to be unanswerable questions. And yes, I know if you read the suttas, there are numerous suttas that talk about the Buddha at the point, at the time of his enlightenment, remembering all of his past lives shortly before he touched the ground. And he saw all of his past lives. And there's numerous stories of other Buddhist sages also knowing their past lives. There's also numerous suttas where the Buddha himself refused to answer such questions. And one of those suttas is the Chulama Lunkya Sutta. In this sutta, one of the bhikkhus basically told the Buddha he was going to leave the Sangha unless the Buddha gave definitive answers to his position on the following issues. It's like a threat. Don't you love this? It's a bhikkhu, a monk who's like threatening the Buddha. These were issues that the Buddha pretty much refused to address. So now the Buddha, hearing his demand, he told the monk, the world is eternal, the world is not eternal. The world is finite, the world is infinite. The soul is the same as the body, the soul is different from the body. A Tathagata comes to an end, a Tathagata does not come to an end. A Tathagata both comes to an end and does not come to an end. A Tathagata neither comes to an end nor does not come to an end. Clearly, the monk is probably not very happy right now. Then the Buddha counseled the monk to consider that pursuing answers to unanswerable questions is like a person who, having been struck by an arrow, fixates only on knowing who shot him and with what poison he was shot, and absolutely refuses to remove the arrow from his body until he knows the answers to those questions. So removing the arrow is akin to seeing causes and conditions from a position of clarity, otherwise known in the Buddhist teachings as right view or wise view. And according to Buddhist philosophy and Paticca-samuppada, which is the doctrine of interdependent co-arising or the 12 links, the world and any other existent material entity cannot be a self-sufficient independent entity due to its nature as a dependently co-arising sensory experience. Hence, the striker. This striker exists along with all the other strikers that have ever existed. It's dependently co-arising with all the other strikers that have ever been, with my hand, with my body, with all your minds, all the chairs in the room. All of this is interdependently co-arising in the here and now. And that is the nature of emptiness. And when we recognize this, which is wise view, there is no other wise view than this. When we recognize this wise view, we are experiencing the ultimate nature of existence. We are no longer in the conventional, experiencing self, body, and world as separate, uncompounded phenomena is a pure reflection. Yet, even though it's a pure reflection, what we see is the impure, unwise, conventional view of reality. Both are simultaneously existing, okay? And by the way, the ultimate view is also empty of any inherent existence. There is nothing that is manifest or unmanifest in any particular moment that is not interdependently co-arising, including the ultimate nature. This is why, in the famous Heart Sutta, it says, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. There is no separation. So now, let's go back to karma and reincarnation from wise view. Why does it matter if you've had a past life? If everything is interdependently co-arising, your current life is no different than any past life you've ever had. The only difference is this is the one you get to train in. And that's, for me, the connection of karma and reincarnation in past lives. This is the one you get to do the work. Whatever's come before has come before. Whatever will come, I guess, maybe. I don't know. When somebody dies, really dies, totally dies, and then comes back and says to us, this is what death is like, I'm all over it. But until such time, for me, it's all supposition. This is the moment now, here and now. And that's when karma and reincarnation have meaning. You get to train the mind and liberate yourself from mental suffering and liberate all beings, which is the icing on the cake. So I think I'm going to stop here. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's show. Groundless Ground Podcast is now available on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. To find out more about this episode, see a list of upcoming guests, or get in touch, visit groundlessground.com. Now let's dedicate our efforts to the healing of our planet and all its inhabitants. See you next time on the Groundless Ground.